So I have a friend from college named Michael Travis. And Michael Travis is like a minor rock star. He's a drummer in a jam band called the String Cheese Incident, which maybe you've never heard of, but they have a lot of fans. And I don't see him that often because he's like a rock star. You don't actually see your rock star friends very often. But I just happened to be with him when they sold out, the first time they sold out a significant venue was the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco. I remember the band kind of huddling up and saying, "We sold out the Great American!" And they were so happy. So I feel like we sold out the Dharma Hall today. So thank you for that. And you know, not like for me, but just, you know, when every time any of us steps forward in some way into our life and we all benefit. And in religion, we do this fabulous job creating this sort of artificial stages and containers and uniforms and all this. And so there was a, you know, there's a stage for me to step into, but why I would do that is for all of us, and we all in some way are stepping in that together. And so what a great, you know, excuse we created to come together tonight and practice and get to do mindful sitting and walking. Well, that was kind of like shuffling, I guess. Well, what a great joy that is to get to be together with so many dear Dharma friends, old and new and from near and far, and practice this way, you know, which is really just about being ourself, you know, just about being a person, just about settling into our life the way it is, working with our resistances and our troubles, you know, as in some new way, maybe, kind of as practice. So anyway, I appreciate that you're here for those reasons, and also feel so supported personally. What a privilege. And I got a big stack of cards and a bunch of emails and stuff. It's nice. So I thought I should tell you a little bit about the Dharma transmission process. In case you're interested. Maybe you're interested since you came. Which is a sort of mysterious process. A lot of our ceremonies, ordination ceremonies, are actually public ceremonies. So we have a precept ceremony where you sew and receive a blue little Buddha bib. And they had a wonderful one of those just the other night in Seattle. So it's a public ceremony. You study Buddha Dharma, and you study the precepts, and you work with people in private in preparation, but the actual ceremony is public. And our novice priest ordination is also a public ceremony. And for whatever reason, our ancestors concocted the next ordination, this Dharma transmission ordination, as a private ceremony. But private and secret are a little bit different things. Privacy is very important for us. Sometimes we need the safety of a private container. So we, and for instance, in formal Zen, we have private interviews. You know, in our lives, we have private conversations and private relationships. And when these are healthy, they're very important and very positive for us. Okay? There's some water in the... Can you get Dove some water? You sure? You okay? Okay. And so, but private is a little different from secret, and so the Dharma transmission ceremony, I suppose, has some secret elements, but it's more private. And so I can share a little bit with you about it, but I couldn't invite you all to go. So my colleague Rick Spencer and I arrived in the evening. You often do this at a temple, so we did this actually kind of a home temple, at our teacher's home temple. So Rick and I arrived one evening at Norman Fisher's home, and his wife Kathy was there as well. And at his home, he has some practice places, these little kind of huts. And the place itself is quite incredible. So, you know how they always say that don't practice Dharma in order to gain anything? Have you heard that? I hope you've heard that. So you're not going to get any goodies, you know. Well, maybe you'll get the goodie of getting to be yourself. That's a good goodie, but then, you know, not to get external goodies. But what happened with Norman Fisher and Kathy Fisher and their family was that they, from their early 20s into their middle 40s, lived like, you know, essentially like monks living inside the Zen community. And because they kind of went straight there out of college, they didn't have a chance to accumulate jobs and resumes and IRAs and money and stuff like that. And so they never owned a house or anything like that. So what happened is somebody gave them a house. So sometimes you do get something. And not just any house. They were given this house, which is like on top of this really tall hill, like on the sea cliff of the Pacific Ocean in this like incredible California neighborhood, little teeny kind of place. And so this sort of little complex, some of the buildings were kind of too funky, they had to tear them down, but they have a house and you can hear the ocean the whole time, and a cliff up above, you can see, you know, the seals and stuff. And then down below there's like a little hut that's like a little zendo and a kind of little study. So this little complex became our monastery for this ceremony, because the ceremony requires some different spaces to do it. And his wife Kathy was not supposed to be there. It was the original plan. And if you were at our Seishin the week before at Samish Island, you might remember Norman mentioning, I think he didn't really mean to mention it, but it was a powerful thing that happened. So he mentioned that Kathy is a big, she's a middle school science teacher, and she's also a big scuba diver. And so every summer she goes on these incredible scuba diving expeditions all over the world, you know, to wherever the best place is to scuba. Nothing stops them, you know. And so she and her scuba diving buddies were in like Western Indonesia, far from everything. And they finally, it took like 5 plane trips and 6 boat rides and stuff like this, long boat ride. And they got into the water and, you know, and they're very organized, methodical divers and do all the safety checks and all that. And they got into the diver and they started their first dive. And exactly 1 minute into their first dive on the other side of the world, you know, one of the, I think there were 5 of them, one of them suddenly looked weird. Something was wrong. They couldn't tell what was going on. And it turned out he died of a heart attack right there in the water. An instant catastrophic, you know, heart attack. They didn't find out till later it was a heart attack. Nothing to do with diving or diving safety or anything like that. He just died. And so they, I won't tell you all about it, but it was very difficult and very traumatic, and he has kids and grandkids and everything. And so they ended the trip early, came home after they took care of his body. And so she really wasn't supposed to be there, but because of death, she was there. And several of the ceremonies include very strong language about life and death. That this is not just like some hobby to make our life a little bit nicer. That this whole process of practicing and looking at what's really arising on every moment is about the whole wheel, in the whole wheel of life and death. And so there are several times in these ceremonies that you ask the teacher, it's all usually scripted, but still powerful scripts, you know. You say something like, you know, because of birth and death, we need to practice. Please, you know, help me. Please give me the tools and the powers to practice the great way of life and death. And so it was sad, but it was in a way really appropriate that she was there. And it was wonderful that she was there too. I know Kathy a little bit and got to know her better. And the other strange thing is, not to go on too long about the Fisher family, but it's interesting, you know. So many ways practice can go. Kathy had been a monk with Norman, but then when there were sort of big changes at San Francisco Zen Center in the mid-80s, she kind of stepped out of that life and went on to become a school teacher. And just a couple of years ago, she doesn't feel like she rejected practice. She just put her focus somewhere else. But just a few years ago, actually starting with one of our retreats at Samus, she kind of came back to practice. And she was ordained and everything, and so part of the ordination process is you sew and wear this robe, which you didn't know I had one before because it was like black on black, you know, so now it's more obvious. And so she had one of these, and when she came to Samus, she kind of restarted practice. She got out, and it was like mildewy and stinky, and like, couldn't wear it, you know. So she'd kind of just gotten back into practice, and so what ended up happening with her coming back early is what she and her teacher decided is she would do Dharma transmission too. So she also did Dharma transmission, just completed last night, actually. So that was quite something. So birth and death was a big theme of this process. The other theme, the other themes were relationship, intimate relationship, and ancestors. And in those ceremonies where you're asking the teacher, you're also asking in light of the ancestors. And there's this, and the whole thing kind of revolves around intimate relationships with the people that are obvious, that are here, and the people who have gone before, and the people who are coming next. But the whole thing is sort of designed to help you really feel and experience in your body that you're not an individual person. You're not an individual person like trying to do practices to improve yourself. But you're just sort of one manifestation of this continually arising thing that we give different sort of religious names, like Buddha Dharma or something. And so that you do lots of stuff to reference and honor and really feel the ancestors. And one of them is that you get up early in the morning. In this case, we got up at 4:30, which is like not too early. You do this in a monastery, you get up a lot earlier. We got up at 4:30 in the morning and went around doing various incense offerings and bells and chanting the names of the ancestors. And with the name of every ancestor, we do a prostration. And so I'm the 93rd generation. And every day we do this. So lots of bowing, lots of chanting, lots of remembering the ancestors. And then the other thing that we did to sort of clarify this relationship, and these are all things you actually do, you know what I mean? And in a way, every teaching is in a way sort of secret because it's not really activated until you actually do it. But the other aspect of this Dharma transmission process, it kind of comes from China. The Chinese civilization is a very advanced early civilization. We kind of forget that now. We think communism, dirty pollution, something, you know. But actually, you know, China is such an ancient and deep civilization, and they early on developed very complex ways of interacting and a lot of interest also in their own ancestors. And they had a very complex and elaborate early legal system and a sort of system of scholastic merit-based, you know, governance, which, you know, wasn't all classes of Chinese civilization. I'm sure there are plenty of peasants, but anyway, well, our his, you know, I mean, nothing's ever quite the way to say, but anyway, while our ancestors, most of us, I think, have European ancestors, you know, in the dark ages, while we were like crawling around in the mud or something like that, they were like writing refined poetry and sitting 3-day exams and drinking very good tea, you know, and so when Buddhism came to China and the sort of Zen movement arose out of that Buddhism, they referenced all that, you know. So, like, for instance, we have these stories called koans, the word which are sort of interesting, sort of unique to Zen, sort of dialogue of intimate encounter and relationship. That's sort of strange, too. And the word koan turns out to mean like a legal precedent, a legal case. So a lot of stuff in Zen actually references the ancient Chinese legal system, you know. So strange. Isn't this stuff strange, you know? Like, you know, we thought awakening. Actually, no, ancient Chinese law is what we're doing. And so they were big on documents, right? Legal system, you got to have documents. So we created Zen documents. It's the other thing we did in our week. Which are, like, you take this great big piece of silk, about this big, this wide, and you copy with a paintbrush, like pen, or a calligraphy brush, sorry, and ink, these lists of ancestors arranged in very particular ways and with particular phrases and particular symbols, and it takes like all day for 3 days to copy these documents. But again, it's the ancestors. You're writing their names. You're thinking of them. And kind of like our process of sewing our own robes, you're also kind of working through, once again, your personality and your stuff, and you're there, and you're trying to do it right, and you're making mistakes, and you're trying to do it better, and you know, you're watching your own everything unfold in the middle of this solemn, you know, highest of the highs and ceremonies. And I don't know, one thing I appreciate about that was I just felt very aware of my own craziness, you know, and my own silliness, and yet you just keep going. Like, at one point I did, like, there was this one document that has a big kind of title. I did it really well. I like did it in kind of a, I sort of picked a script, you know. I didn't just copy it. I did it even better, you know. And you're copying a previous, you're copying an ancestor, essentially. In this case, I was copying a senior practitioner who had done this 5 years earlier, and I did even better than hers, you know. And when I finished, I wanted to go inside and show everybody, you know. And so I said, huh, look at that, you know. I want validation, you know. So I did take it inside, but they were talking about something else, so. I folded it up again and just joined the conversation. You know, so, you know, most of this work done silently, and, you know, and you're just looking at what is this, you know, what is this life? What is this transmission in the context of these ancestors? And the other thing we did in preparation, one of the things we did in preparation was we studied some of the writings of Dogen, who's the Japanese founder of this school. From 12, he lived 1200 to 1253. And Dogen was very impressed by these same things when he went to China, and he talks about it. And in the context of doing the ceremony, you kind of get it a little more, what he was moved by, what he felt. And for instance, before we chanted these names of the ancestor and did all these prostrations early in the morning, we chanted a little writing from Dogen. I didn't realize it was Dogen until after I got home and saw it there. We chanted, "Actualizing Buddha ancestors means to uphold and see them in veneration. It is not limited to Buddhas of past, present, and future, but is going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. It is taking up those who have maintained the face and eye of Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and encountering them. They have manifested the power of the Buddha ancestors, dwelt in it, and actualized it in the body." So he writes, you know, he has a funny style, so I'm read that again. But you can hear what I was just talking about is right there in Dogen. From, he wrote this, I think, in about 1230, you know, so a while ago. "Actualizing Buddha ancestors means to uphold and see them in veneration. It is not limited to Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but is going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. It is taking up those who have maintained the face and eye of Buddha ancestors, formally bowing and encountering them. They have manifested the power of the Buddha ancestors, dwelt in it, and actualized it in the body." So entering, he ends with the body. We sometimes think of practice as so heady, don't we? You know, like, I got to figure this out, you know. Got to meditate. Actually in the body. And then in this particular chapter of his great book of essays, he lists off all the ancestors after that. And then he ends by describing the same kind of situation when he was in his teacher's room, just like Rick and I were in Norman's room. He wrote, "I saw Ruzhing, my late master, old Buddha Tiantong, at the time of the summer practice period in the first year of the Baojing era, 1227. And with a formal bow, completely received these Buddha ancestors. This can only occur between a Buddha and a Buddha." And the other big thing that we did were a bunch of ceremonies. And in these ceremonies, using all these symbols, all these powerful religious symbols, you know, which in a way are all made up, right? That's what humans do, right? They make up culture. But also have a certain depth and power to them, partly just through our own inhabiting them. And part of why we have a kind of a slow process, you know, I think that we all come into Zen with some idea of gaining something and learning something and attaining something and becoming something. And so it might sound like Dharma transmission. Oh, that's in America, we only do that after many years, and it must mean the person has really attained something, right? It's like marking that. So you might think that somebody's really attained something. I think it's not that exactly, though. You know, there are changes and things happen, otherwise why do this? You know, there's maybe some settling and some realizing something, I don't know. But it's not like you attain some better mind or something. It's more that the why you would do this ceremony only after many years is you've had enough time to settle into your life in this context so that you can inhabit these powerful symbols without being, you know, so, you know, without being sort of overwhelmed by them. So I don't think it doesn't mean that the person becomes sort of more special or graduated or something like that. Panabasa Bhikkhu, who is visiting with us today, nice to have you here, was telling me that in the Burmese forest tradition, it's just purely the number of years. After 20 years, you're a Mahatera. That's it, you know. So just hang in there, you know. You know, you got to be a monk in good standing, and you know, it's not like they did nothing. They did good practices and some amount of other things, I'm sure. But, you know, so, you know, this whole thing is not, you know, I think it's easily misunderstood as attaining something, but maybe it's more just a way of sort of enacting a kind of gradual maturity or something. Like, you know, as children, maybe we start out when we're born in some way, sort of, you know, undifferentiated state of some kind, maybe as children, not separating things, just existing. And then quickly we learn language, and we learn if it's this, it's not that, and we separate things, and we learn that I'm separate from everybody else, and we become empowered in a way, but also isolated, right? Also alone. You know, there's a big root of suffering there in that separation. And so maybe Dharma practice or any true spiritual practice is a kind of, you know, circling back around, feeling this non-differentiation, feeling this connection between yourself and the world, yourself and whatever symbol you need. And maybe you need Buddha, maybe you need Zen ancestors, you know, if that's your trip, you know. Good, you know, please use them well. Please love the ancestors. Maybe you need another different form. And you're not like a child again. That's not the same. We've somehow come around to some understanding that the language and the separation is itself just a convention, you know, not really so real as we thought. So there's a whole series of ceremonies, and it's okay. I could tell you about them in detail, but you just forget anyway, so we won't waste our time. But some are very simple, you know, very short. They're all private, just you and the teacher in the room. And the other interesting thing about the Zen tradition that kind of differentiates it from other Buddhist traditions is once you have this sort of strong tradition of ancestors, then the teacher, you know, then the abbot becomes a very important figure in a way, is sort of raised up above Buddha in some ways. And so it's interesting. These ceremonies are all done in the abbot's room, not in the Buddha hall, not in the Zen hall, but in the abbot's room privately. And so there are some of the ceremonies in which your teacher, in a very conspicuous way, like really stands in, sits in for Buddha. You know, there's a special ceremonial chair and special chants are done, and he sits down, and or she, and he or she is Buddha, you know, and you really feel it in the ceremony. And then part of the ceremony, you know, you change places. The student sits in that seat, and you're Buddha, you know. So, you know, does it make you Buddha? You already were Buddha. You already are Buddha. All of us. The two main ceremonies at the end, one is about precepts and one is about lineage, again. And it's interesting about the Bodhisattva precepts, especially the way they're done in Soto Zen, is it's always the same precepts. You know, it's interesting. You would think there would be like advanced precepts. You know? The way we think about things, right? Like, I'm a beginner now. He's advanced. He probably has, you know. But it's actually the exact same precepts, and all of Zen is kind of that way. They say it's the same at the beginning, you know, the same at the middle, the same at the end. But in a way, it's different, in a way, it's the same. And so, in one of the big ceremonies at the end called Denkai, Kai is the same Kai as like in Jukai, so precepts. You receive the same precepts again, the same 16, the first three about paying homage to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So they actually fold Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in as precepts. The next three about a sort of universal aspiration to do good and benefit others. And then there are 10 more specific ones. And so if you've been around, you've heard them. But if not, I just want to mention kind of the outline of it. You know, it's basic stuff that's universal to all moral systems, all religions. Not killing, not stealing, being careful about speech and the body and sexuality. You know, all the usual stuff. But in this ceremony, it's just the same precepts again, but just done with a more powerful container, such that it empowers you to then, in turn, be able to give these precepts in other ceremonies. And so that's like the sort of logistical change, I guess. Because once you've gone through the Dharma transmission, you can yourself give precepts in our other precept ceremonies. The Jukai, the lay receiving precept ceremony, and the priest ordination. But same precepts, you know. So it's the same. And, you know, in a way, maybe the whole design is just sort of designed to just try to get it through our thick skulls one more time that you're okay already. You're complete already. Your precepts are the full precepts. There's no secret life. There's no other you. There's no more, no new teachings. But actually, there are a few little secret things. I won't say about those, but... you know, maybe that wasn't the Buddha's plan, but who knows. And then, so that's the first ceremony. So then you receive the precepts in a new way. And then the second, this is sort of the penultimate ceremony, is then you receive all the gear. You have to gear you up. But again, pulling out all the stops with big, powerful, symbolic ceremonies. And part of how religion works, which I've really come to appreciate, is we'll have all these things that we always do it the same way. And you'd always do it the same way for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And then at a certain point you go to a ceremony, you do it a different way. And then it's like, whoa, you know. And so if you had, you know, so if you hadn't already been sort of acculturated to the usual way, it wouldn't have any power at all. But since you are acculturated to the other way, it becomes very powerful. And so like ordained people always spread this little cloth before they bow, which originally was a sitting cloth, so you can see. In use the original way. And so when you spread it out, you don't just spread it out, you spread it and you fold it, right, a particular way, right? So in all the ceremonies in Dharma transmission, you spread it out all the way, you know, so it's very powerful, you know. And then in this final ceremony, not only do you spread it out, but you spread it out and you lay it on top of your teachers, which is like, you know, it's like touching somebody's, you know, something, you know. I mean, you never would touch somebody's, you know, robes, you know. That's what this ceremony you do, you know. That's what's done, you know. So, yeah, so again, just some powerful, beautiful ceremonies. And in that ceremony, you receive the... And this is the kind of biggest ceremony of succession, which was invented by the Zen people. They say they went back to the Buddha, where the teacher, the symbols of office, you know, the real symbols are the robe and the bowl, the robe and the bowl. And the earliest form of practice, the original monks, which Panabosa is practicing, that's kind of like your only possession, so it's a big deal. You have one bowl, which is what you eat from, and you only eat what's offered into your bowl. And you have one robe or one set of robes. And so in our practice, which is elaborated from that, you know, the robes are more symbolic. I don't wear this every day, but it's a powerful symbol. So you receive the robe and the bowl and the staff, which is like, you know, an obvious symbol from like kings, right? So this is like the Dharma King's staff, which Bob made for us. Thank you, Bob. Very beautiful. And some other gear that you use in other ceremonies. But again, done privately with lots of prostrations. And the other part of these last two ceremonies is they're only done at night. Only done at night. And sometime around midnight is best. So that just adds, you know, you're sort of, you know, in the daytime, our sort of fantasy of separation is more alive, right? But in the middle of the night, maybe better if they do it at like 4 in the morning or 3 in the morning or something, but they do it in the middle of the night. You know, this is sort of the dream time, right? Where these symbols are more alive and are sort of subconscious, you know, sort of beyond conceptual life. The life of emptiness is more present. And just logistically, some of the ceremonies involve a very dark room and lighting a candle, and you actually examine some of these documents you created in a very sort of powerful way in the dark, you know. So it's very, very beautiful, very powerful. So hopefully, if some of you are very traditional practitioners, you won't be offended by me telling you all these things, but I just thought you know, probably won't talk about this again, but I just thought you'd like to know what the process is and my sense, a little bit of my sense of what it might mean or what it might not mean. Here's a little bit more from Dogen about receiving these documents. When Dogen went to China, Somehow he finagled an invitation with various abbots, or at least he says he did, at these Chinese monasteries to see their secret documents, to see their private transmission documents. And he saw several of them. And it's one of the things that scholars now are a little, in some ways, a little doubtful of his story. It didn't seem like you would show a new Japanese monk your documents, but, I mean, he certainly saw some. And he certainly saw his teachers. But here's what he wrote about seeing those documents. The meaning of the document of heritage is this. Seeing it, you understand the sun, the moon, the stars, and inherit Dharma. You attain skin, flesh, bones, and merit, and inherit Dharma. You inherit a robe or a staff, a pine branch or a whisk, an Udambara blossom or a brocade robe. You receive straw sandals and an arched bamboo staff. At the time of the Dharma heritage, the document is handwritten with the blood of the finger or the tongue. You can put blood in the oil, in the ink. Or it is handwritten with oil or milk. Each one of these is a document of heritage. Those who entrust and those who receive this heritage are both the Buddha's heirs. Indeed, whenever Buddha ancestors are actualized, Dharma heritage is actualized. At the time of actualization, innumerable Buddha ancestors arrive without expectation and receive Dharma without seeking. Those who inherit Dharma are all Buddha ancestors. Let's do that last paragraph again. Those who entrust and those who receive this heritage are both the Buddha's heirs. Indeed, whenever Buddha ancestors are actualized, Dharma heritage is actualized. At the time of actualization, innumerable Buddha ancestors arrive without expectation and receive Dharma without seeking. Those who inherit Dharma are all Buddha ancestors. And so the external meaning of this seems to be you go through this week-long ceremony after 20 years and you get to do this, but I think the inner meaning is all of us are doing this all the time. You know, every moment there's this possibility of showing up, right? This possibility of really showing up without expectation, like he says, and receiving the Dharma without seeking. And that the Buddha ancestors are not someone else. All of us who allow that opening, that receiving, are Buddha ancestors on that moment. Because this was a powerful process, and I'm really grateful to my teacher and the tradition and to all of you. But, I can't tell you that I understand the sun, the moon, and the stars. And I don't know whether I've inherited the skin, the flesh, the bones, and the marrow of the Dharma. That's not really important. There's something deeper happening in our life than what we can think about. And maybe one way to think about all this is a sort of development of trust. Trust in something bigger than myself. And maybe that slowly builds up as we practice steadily over time. And maybe even despite our bright ideas and our new theories and our learning and our thinking, maybe there's some deep trust that can develop. And we can put all kinds of names on this. Grace, faith, touching the mind ground. And it does seem to take a while. I was thinking too about if this is like graduating or something like that, I started practice 25 years ago. I did the math. And people here have practiced longer than that. And I was thinking, if it was about sort of like attaining something or acquiring something, if I add up all those years and all those hours, I could probably have like 2 or 3 PhDs by now, easy. And so could you. So it's not about that. It's some kind of settling out. It involves some skillfulness, it involves some deliberation, it involves some discipline and some choices. You're not going to sit on the cushion and really practice just because you've sort of tripped on something, You're not going to come to the Dharma Hall tonight just because you didn't have anything else to do. Maybe that's the case. There's some, the mind that chooses and the mind that makes decisions and the mind that evaluates is certainly involved. And we hope that mind can feel a little better, but there's something below that happening. And somehow, little by little, we realize that we can take our place in the lineage and in the world. And little by little, maybe as this trust develops, we can learn how to really trust ourselves, just the way we are. And what I've been really noticing lately, and the Sangha container has been so helpful for me to learn about this, so thank you for your patience with me as I study this, that, you know, when we don't trust somebody else, it's really about ourselves. So please study that. When there's that sense of graspy or resistance or judgment, maybe it's really just your own self that needs to be trusted more fully. So I'm trying to work with that. But anyway, what does all this mean for us as a community? And I know there are people here beyond just the immediate Bellingham Zen community. Thank you so much for coming. Well, not a whole lot. You know, we'll just more or less continue. The practice is the same, right? Having somebody in different colored robes is not a huge game changer. But maybe little by little will be helpful. But we'll keep our Zazen schedule. We'll keep having practice periods. It might be that I'll start leading some of those practice periods in the way that Norman has in the past. It might be that over time I'll be the preceptor at the Jukai ceremonies, if we have more Jukai ceremonies, if people want to do that. It might be that eventually we'll have more priests ordained by me or ordained by Kate and Michael in Vancouver, who are actually this very moment, I think, what day? What's the date today? 13th? Yeah. They're at this very moment, taking 8:30. They're at this very moment preparing for one of these final ceremonies. That's wonderful, huh? Yeah. So after dark, one of them will, I think tonight will be the receiving this precept ceremony for them. So yeah, so they'll also be in the same status, I guess. So maybe our Dharma connection with Vancouver will be even stronger, of them coming to teach and do ceremonies. And, you know, that I happen to be sitting in the seat, I just see as a strange sort of coincidence of karma. You know, who'd have thunk? So I'll just try to do my best, and I'm sure you will too. But not to think that, you know, there's only so much space or something like that, or there's only so much oxygen. All of us, you know, the invitation is here for all of us to take the next step, to take the next step in practice. Whatever that is for us, and that's a real process of discovery for all, each of us. It may be formal things in the Zen tradition. It may be studying and sewing special things and special ceremonies, or it might not be. It might be the next step for you is a subtle kind of inward work that none of us are even going to see, except maybe one day we'll notice, well, you seem a little happier. That's nice, you know. That would be good. But even if that doesn't happen, that's okay. Maybe the next step for you will be, you know, in some way working with daily practice in a new way, or studying in some different way. Or it might be coming more to the Dharma Hall, or it might be coming less to the Dharma Hall. We don't know. But in some profound way, you know, each of us noticing this invitation that's arising all the time in our life to turn towards our life a little more fully and to see these problems and these difficulties and these conditioning and these personality traits, whatever it is, you know, that gets your goat, not as like problems to get rid of, but as gates of the Dharma. So after the talk, we're going to chant something about Dharma gates are boundless. Dharma gates are boundless. We vow to enter them. I'm sorry we didn't manage to pass out the little books. Maybe for that we can. So that's what Dharma transmission is. You know, it's for all of us. Oh, hi, Paul. I see you there. Thank you. Because because the other thing that's powerfully wonderful about Sangha practice is whenever any of us takes these steps, whether it's apparent to others or not, we all benefit. The whole community benefits, and broader than just the obvious Dharma community benefits. So that really helps us. And even if you're the kind of person who thinks, well, I don't deserve to be happy, well, do it for us. You know, shut up already. If you're the kind of person who thinks, I have to do it for all them, then no, no. Please take care of yourself. Don't worry about us. So each of us, you know, needs to make that discernment. And we can help each other, too, making that discernment. We're not on our own. And the other logistical difference, we'll talk more about these kind of things later, I guess, but is the format of individual meetings with me changes a little bit, so we'll work out how to do that logistically. It's a little bit more formal. Well, may the benefit of our coming together tonight help others who need our help. May our practice bring a little bit of more ease and a little more joy to our world and all the suffering that is here. And let's also, after we bow and chant, please stay and we'll have a little party. Okay? Thank you so much. I really appreciate everyone coming in. And if I don't get a chance during the little party, which I know I won't with so many of us, to say thank you to each of you individually, please, if you don't mind, if you can accept that globally, I really so much appreciate every person coming, and even if you just wandered in and no idea this was happening, thank you. You just wanted meditation. So, can we pass out the chant books? It's a little more polite when people are visiting to give them what they need. So on the second page, maybe. And if you don't know this, you can just, if you do know it, you can just let the basket go by. There's a little chant to do at the end. And, you know, maybe we'll also, we'll pull all the stops. We have time, I think. So we'll do the closing of the Dharma chant. And we'll do our three prostrations. And then why don't we sing together? Let's do the Tisarana, the refuge in Pali, at least the way we pronounce it.
So the